Richard Dawkins was once asked by someone who was thinking of becoming an atheist, "Can you recommend a book for me to read to sort of help me on my way?" And he said, "Yeah, the Bible." And you know, the man's got a point, because believing in the God of the Bible, I don't mean like God in the abstract, but believing in the God of the Bible is not always easy. See, first of all, he lives in the sky. And Jesus ascends, he goes up to the sky to be with the Father, and like, where are they? Because there's really, technically speaking, no sky, right? Its atmosphere just keeps going for like a bazillion trillion light years and forever. Or the God of the Bible endorses and supports the structures of slavery. There are even laws there about how to govern slaves, but there's nothing about emancipating them. Or God is transactional. Right? If you obey, you'll be blessed. If you disobey, you'll be cursed. Which sounds a little harsh, you know, not like, oh, I can't wait to get to know this God. It seems a little bit tense, you know? Or God's sort of go-to means of conflict resolution in the Bible seems to be a lot of people die. Violence, right? I mean, war, pestilence, plague, famine, the ground opens up to swallow a few thousand people. I mean, think about this. Our big, long Bible, right? Genesis, you get to chapter 6 and everybody dies. Oh, Lord, that's it? That's all you got? This, you've already run out of patience. It's chapter 6 of the Bible, for heaven's sake. There's no plan B, in other words, right? Or God is very concerned about his reputation, honor, and shame. Don't shame me. I will be honored. I will be glorified. Which, again, is a bit harsh. It's like my students say, it seems like God is a little bit self-centered and really too concerned about what he looks like to other people. Or there are laws. Laws are fine. I'm not against law or anything like that. But some of the laws in the Bible, I mean, This is what the universe is about, right? Okay, you see that animal over there? You can eat that one. You see the one over there? I know it looks like that one, but it's got different kind of hooves and it chews differently. Unclean, don't eat it. And that thing, it's coming out of the water, you think it's a fish, but it's not. It's got a hard shell. You can't eat that either. Oh, and let me see. You can stone your rebellious teenage son, and virgin daughters are the property of their fathers. Thus saith me. Any questions? Or God micromanages everything in the Bible. It seems like everything happens according to the word of the Lord. He even micromanages the weather as a form of punishment or reward. I remember years ago, Pat Robertson of the 700 Club was talking about a hurricane that was descending on the coast of Virginia. And he said, this is God's punishment for the state of Virginia. I don't remember if they voted wrong or something. I have no idea what they did. But that night, John Stewart said, isn't it funny how God's wrath always shows up during hurricane season? I miss him terribly, by the way. But I remember thinking to myself, that's it, right? That's the problem. The God of the Bible, the way he's portrayed, it's not easy to believe in this God because it doesn't fit our common experience. And our experience is going to affect how we think about God. Now, I've been told many times, you should never let your experience affect your theology. I'm like, well, what else do I got? I mean, I can't help it when and where I was born. I could teleport back into the Iron Age. That might be easier, but I can't do that. I live here, so I have to reimagine what God is like. And here's the good thing. See, the Bible, okay, it's sort of a problem, right? But the Bible also provides, it models a way forward. It's not a silver bullet, it's not an easy answer, but it models something for us that I think is of great spiritual benefit. It's basically this. The writers of the Bible are already reimagining the God of old for new experiences and new circumstances. I think that's a beautiful thing. See, this is why, you know, of all the great stories in the Old Testament that I think talk about this, my two favorite are the books of Jonah and Job. Because they're both about reimagining what God is like. So how does Jonah reimagine God? Well, Jonah, I'm not sure how you're going to take this, but I actually like your enemies, and I want them to prosper, and I want them saved, or whatever word we want to use. Even the Assyrians, the dreaded Assyrians, who were like the superpower semi-ISIS of the day, even them. Jonah doesn't like it, but he does it, and it works. See, the book of Jonah is reimagining the God of, let's say, the book of Nahum, another one of the minor prophets, where there, it's a very different tone about the Assyrians. There, God uses language like vengeance and destroy, and I've had it with you. And then the town of Nineveh, the city, the capital of Assyria, is wiped out. Now, Nahum has a little bit of like historical veracity to it in this sense, that in the year 612 BCE, the capital of Nineveh fell. Jonah is a parable. It's not about a fish. It's not about any of that stuff. It's a parable about who's an insider and who's an outsider to the God of the universe. And he gives a different kind of answer. Jonah reimagines what God is like. Because Jonah was written after the return from the Babylonian exile. So what? Here's a so what. They're in a captivity for, what, 50, 60 years. And they're getting to know people who were their enemies. And they're sort of like, honey, have you met the Babylonian neighbors? They're like really, really nice. I mean, I don't understand a word they're saying, but they're like, they're nice. And I think they want us to come over for dinner or something. And they want a play date with our kids. They have beer, for heaven's sake. This is like the most amazing place. Maybe, you know what? We could have been Babylonians had we been born here. But we were born someplace else. Is God just our private possession, or is God bigger than we might imagine? Maybe God cares for the enemy too. I had a similar experience. When I left seminary to go to graduate school, people said, okay, you go to Harvard, just don't learn anything. Just keep your head low. Don't just go to a good church, blah, blah, other kind of stuff. I ignored every word they said. But I got there, and I realized that these people, well, forgive me, people, you know, and who had no idea what I was thinking about. No idea. They couldn't really articulate what I believed. That's because they were born in Israel or other parts of the world. And I remember thinking to myself, first of all, they're nice people. And I enjoy their company, and they babysat my kids. But are they really on the outside looking in, and I'm on the inside looking out because of where I was born? Had I been born there, I'd be like them. Had they been born here, they might have been like me. So what kind of a God are we talking about here? If I can have compassion on them, oh, so help me, God better have more compassion than I do. I had to reimagine God from what I was taught based on my experience. Or the book of Job. I love the book of Job. Job reimagines God this way. Hey, are you suffering? Yeah, God's not doing that to you. Right? You know the story of Job? He's not doing well, okay? His friends come to him and they say, Job, you don't look too good. What did you do to deserve that? Right? Because see, his friends, they're working from this idea of a transactional God. If you obey, you'll be blessed. If you disobey, you'll be cursed. And they go to Job and they say, you know, Job, I've read the book, and like for the first few verses, you're doing great, right? You're blessed, like way blessed, more than anybody else. And you're like the best Yahweh worshiper ever in the history of humanity. It's like you do everything and you're so scrupulous. You see, there's got to be a causal connection. You obeyed and you're blessed. Now you're clearly cursed. Ipso facto, what did you do? What did you do to make that transaction change? And of course, what does Job say? Nothing. And his friends say, yeah, you did. And Job says, no, I didn't. And his friends say, yes, you did. And Job says, no, I didn't. And his friends say, yeah, you did. And Job says, no, I did. 36 chapters of this back and forth to drive home the point, right? And what's beautiful is you get to the end of this complicated and sort of weird ending to the book, but there's one moment in this book which for me is literally the highlight of the entire Old Testament. It's when Job is there with the friends. They're still friends apparently, but Job is with the friends and God shows up. And he looks at one of Job's friends and he says, my wrath is kindled against you and your friends, for you have not spoken rightly of me as my friend Job has. You catch that? Right? The boys are doing the whole transactional thing over here, and Job's like, okay, I get it, and I did that in chapter one. But something happened. God can't be like that. I refuse to believe that God is like that. And God backs him up. It should be that easy, right? When we get into theological debates. God backs him up. See, this is a radical reimagining of the way God is portrayed. Forgive me, throughout much of the Old Testament, not all of it, but read Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, a bunch of the prophets, a bunch of other things. It's very transactional. And Job takes that to task. He's reimagining God. Why? Just like Jonah. On the basis of his experience, he's got to think about God differently. And speaking of thinking of God differently, let's talk about the Jesus part of the Bible, right? You've got the gospel. What is the gospel if not a rather hefty, sustained reimagining of the God of old? Not dismissing the God of old, but reimagining the God of old just the way Jews have been doing it for centuries before. Think of anything of semi-importance in the Old Testament. Something happens with it in the New. Think like the land, which is not semi-important. That's hugely important. All right, Abraham, here you go. I promise you this land is a perpetual holding. Don't screw it up, right? And if you're in the land, that means I'm happy with you. If you're outside the land, it means I'm not happy with you, right? Jesus, my kingdom is not of this world. Yeah, it is. It's about this geopolitical entity called the land of Canaan, which our God promised to us as a... this is the point. But you see, Jesus is reimagining what God is like. Maybe God isn't concerned about that piece of real estate. Or the temple, right? Temple's sort of a big deal in the Old Testament, right? This is where... Well, a lot of stuff happens. The glory of God resides there. The Spirit of God is there. All these things. It's like this is the hub to connect with God. And what does Jesus say? I'm the temple. And then Paul takes it a step further, as he usually does, and he says to the church at Corinth, which was a loser church, by the way. They had nothing going for them, nothing right. He says to the church at Corinth, you are the temple of the Holy Spirit. See, it's reimagining the way in which God communes with humanity. That is a radical major shift. Or the law, right? The law is sort of important in the Old Testament, right? Here's the law. The law is that thing which defines the behaviors and the attitudes and the essence of what it means to be a child of Abraham. And Paul comes along and he says, doesn't throw it out, doesn't get rid of it, but he moves it to the periphery. The law now has a different function. And in its place, he puts, well, Jesus. So he says to the Gentiles, you too can be a child of Abraham, full-fledged child of Abraham, equal with your Jewish brothers and sisters, but not by this part, but by this part. That is a radical act of reimagining God and the community of God. We know this because Paul got a ton of opposition from his own Jewish brothers who were also followers of Jesus, said, Paul, you went too far. Even Peter... Right? Jesus's like handpicked super disciple, right? It's too much for him. And James, Jesus's brother, I want to repeat that. Jesus's own brother, both of them are like rulers of the leaders of the church in Jerusalem. For them, it went too far. And Paul said, no, that's the gospel. And Paul won. Paul's act of reimagining the God of old won. And I know that because I'm standing here and I'm a Gentile. And I'm talking about Jesus, and you're out there, and if you're not of Jewish heritage, we all benefit from that radical act of reimagining. The church doesn't exist without that act of reimagining the God of old. And then for me, the big thing that, I have to tell you, this is the one that keeps me going some days when I'm not feeling great about all this stuff, yeah, which happens. And it's the cross. It's not enough to say, and I wish no one taught me this, and that bothers me. No one ever pointed this out to me. There's something I've always missed about this. The cross is not just, well, Jesus died for your sins, or Jesus suffered and died for your sins. It's Jesus was humiliated and shamed for you. In fact, God participates in this shaming and humiliating activity. That's what a cross is. The Romans perfected this means of execution, which was not just a... Jesus could have been beheaded. Why crucifixion? That's what the Romans do, and its purpose, this is documented, its purpose is to humiliate and to shame. And so this is how God shows up. The God of honor of the Old Testament, of mountains and all this creation, he shows up aligned with crucifixion. That's utter nonsense. Which Paul says, to the Jews, it's a stumbling block. You better believe it is. To the Greeks, it's an offense. It's outrageous. It's ridiculous. Yeah, it is. But for us, it's the wisdom of God. That is a major act of reimagining what God is like. Or in Romans, he says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. Why would he be ashamed? Because of how it begins. Right? See, okay, if you're living in the Greco-Roman world, or frankly, any time in human history, you're going to start a religion? Number one, okay, guys, we're agreed. We're not going to have our God shamed, right? Okay, good. Check that off the box. This is how it begins. So Paul has to say, I'm not ashamed, even though I know I should be, because that shaming is the power of God. That is a major act of reimagining what God is like. Our whole faith is based on this. And I think we all reimagine God. I know I do, like, all the time. It drives me crazy. But I don't know what else to do. I have to align my experience with my faith somehow. I have to have at least talking to each other. The big one for me is, you know, the universe. How big can you get? That's the big one for me. It's just, it's very big. And it's also teeny tiny. And it's also very, very old. And now I've got to think of a God and wrap my arms around all that. And also this God cares about me. Right? How can you have a personal God with a universe that's that big and impersonal? That's not a small question to ask. You know, does God count the hairs on my head? Does he listen when I pray? Listen, I stopped praying for a parking space at the mall a long time ago, all right? I'm not looking for that kind of individualized attention, but just a little bit of a sense of, like, how do I know that I matter in this tremendous cosmos we live in? Or evolution. I mean, I wrote a book about evolution a few years ago, and I think about that a lot, and it's not really compatible with Christianity that I can see. It's not really compatible. And it's not because of Adam. That is, frankly, forgive me, that is child's play. That's the easiest thing to deal with. The hard part is how much time it took, how relatively random it seems, and the fact that what makes evolution go is death. Death is evolution's buddy. Okay? Death is Christianity's enemy. Okay, now, work it out. How do those things come to? That's hard work, but it's an act of reimagination. Mental health, right? My family, there was mental health on both sides. My kids never had a chance, by the way. It just came down genetically, forget it, right? But, I mean, I get it. But the thing is that when something happens, I know where I need to go. To a really good doctor and a really good therapist and get the medication regulated. Right, I don't like, I got to pray and God will solve this. It's not reading the Bible or going to a Bible study or listening to a sermon series. That's not going to address it. It's like, okay, Lord, she's depressed. Why don't you sit this one out? I'm going to go call a psychiatrist and maybe you're busy with, just take care of ISIS and hunger and I'll just worry about this. So again, see, it's a matter of, is God really... Are we just chemicals, you know, and what does it mean to have a God over us, and how do these things work together? And that's, I don't really know the answer to that, but I know that I have to think about God differently. I have to make room in my experience for a God like this. And I'm not looking for things. You know, it's just, I'm just alive and aware and breathing, and these things just hit me, and I'm just scratching the surface, as I'm sure you are too. Now, here's the thing. I could be wrong. I could be really, really wrong about how I reimagine God. But I am not wrong for trying. Right? Reimagining God and asking, what is God like here and now? That is the question of faith. That is the question of theology. And when I try to answer that question, I'm not being disloyal to the tradition. I'm actually doing what the tradition's already been doing. I'm not attacking the tradition and trying to kill it. I'm trying to keep it going, at least for myself, by addressing things and taking things into account that the tradition itself never dreamed of. When I'm trying to answer this question for myself, it's not like I'm being fast and loose with all this stuff. I'm actually taking my faith seriously and my experience seriously. Trying to answer the question, what is God like here and now? It's not trendy. It's not foolish. It's not foolhardy. It's not rebellion. It is, in fact, nothing less than our sacred responsibility as people of faith. Thank you.